Hello and welcome to episode 95 of the Blue Cup Tools podcast. I'm Francisco Gonzalez, also known as Grunislav, and with me as always.
Hello, I am Ben Sandler, also known as Ben304. How are you, Professor Gonzalez?
Professor?
I get to call you that now.
But I don't have a PhD.
That's for doctor, isn't it?
Yeah, but to have the title of professor in a college or university setting, you are required to have a PhD.
Yeah, but we're not in a college or university setting.
No.
We're in your apartment.
Well, I'm in my apartment. You'll be in my apartment next week, but
my voice is in your apartment.
Well, your voice is actually technically in my ears because I'm wearing
headphones. Speaking metaphysically, please. You're the worst professor I've ever encountered. I don't like this course at all.
I'm not a bad professor. I'm an intellectual. I am debunking your metaphysical... anyway, to answer your question...
My metaphysical...
Yeah, I don't know. I don't deal with
it. I don't have a metaphysical...
I'm not a professor in mumbo jumbo, okay? So...
Mumbo jumbo.
I like that word. I like saying that. Anyway...
It makes me think of a snack.
Yeah, it kind of does.
Mumbo jumbo. Like jambalaya, but...
Yeah. Mumbo jambalaya.
Delicious.
Yes.
Good for breakfast.
Anyway, to answer your question, I'm doing okay. As I was just telling you minutes before we started recording, I think I might be coming down with a cold, which I hope is not the case, because my throat...
You sound like the fact that you sniffled.
Yeah, my nose has been a little runny and stuffy for the past day, and my throat was feeling a little funny this morning, but... It isn't really feeling that bad anymore, so hopefully it'll just be one of those like 2 day colds that goes away really quick.
Give it time.
Yeah, but yeah, aside from that, I'm all right. How are you doing?
I am well, thank you.
Are you working right now?
I am.
I see. How responsible. It's Saturday morning.
I am responsible. Yeah, I mean, you know.
What about?
I don't want to make sort of out of proportion claims of responsibility, but I do what I have to.
Okay.
I do what I must, you know.
That's fair. Yeah, so you called me Professor Grunislav. Why? Because I taught that class yesterday?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And you're a professor of adventure games.
I suppose. I'm a professor of adventure game design theory, if teaching a class four times gives you that particular
Has it been
skill.
The same class that you've repeated four times, or it has been four different classes on the same topic?
It's the same class that I've repeated four times at different times.
So you don't have to make up new things?
Well, I do, actually, because I like to keep it fresh just for my own sake.
That's fair.
Even though you get different students and stuff. Like, yesterday was the most smallly attended class I've taught.
Most smallly attended class.
Listen.
Thank you.
I knew that it was bad when I said it. I didn't think I was going to get called out.
I know
on
how
it.
That is. It's a Friday. I'll give you this Friday.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, it was the least populously attended class that I taught.
That didn't make it better.
Well, I don't care. Anyway, there was only 3 people in attendance.
Oh, gosh. Wow, that's difficult. Does that make it difficult or easier? Actually?
It actually made it a little easier because I said, you know, we have more one-on-one availability. So if you have any questions as I'm talking, please feel free to interrupt me and you know, ask specific detailed questions. So, you know, I mean, I have my basic lecture structure and I have my slides and things. But this time around, I tried a little something different because I mostly focus on writing and puzzle design in the class. So since there was only 3 people, I decided to do some world building and character design exercises. Cause like, I've tried in the past to do like an on the fly, let's design a puzzle and, you know, go around the room and ask people for input. And that hasn't really worked because it gets pretty crazy and convoluted and silly. But this time around, I was like, okay, let's each of you, I'm going to write down some things to consider for how to build a world. Like, you know, where is it located? Where is your game going to be set? What planet is it on? What are the politics of this world? How does the structure work? Et cetera, et cetera. So take 5 minutes and write something down. I gave them more like 10. So they each wrote something down and then they read it to me and they came up with really good stuff. Like, I was impressed at how
you sound surprised that these people interested in game design came up with interesting ideas.
Well, yes, to an extent, I kind of was. Like, I mean, they came up with really interesting ideas. I was expecting like kind of run of the mill, whatever. But they came up with really like they all named their places really interesting things, which I thought was pretty cool. One guy did like a a sort of it was actually like two sci-fi things and one post-apocalyptic thing, which was kind of cool. So then I asked them to, after they did that, to come up with, I wrote down three professions on the board, and I was like, you know, this is just to give you an idea, pick one. I think I wrote like pirate, mechanic, and king or ruler in the society. And I was
like, I never thought of a pirate as being a profession. A privateer, yes, but not a pirate.
Well, just like, you know, what they do to sort of give you the character archetype. I basically was saying, let's take a boring, you know, cliche occupation and the exercises to make it interesting. So I wrote down my three little questions that Jennifer Holloway taught me, and I explained sort of the philosophy behind them. And I said, okay,
Would you like to share that with the class that's listening now who are all interested in adventure game design?
Have I not before?
Well,
okay,
refresher course.
Well, the three questions are, would this character be late for dinner? And that's basically sort of to get a basic idea and snowball it. Like, yes, they'd be late for dinner because they're busy. Their work keeps them busy because they're really into their work. They're the type of person that's such a professional that they forget to eat. Or, no, they wouldn't be late for dinner because they value punctuality and they think that if you're late, that's a sign of disrespect, and they're very, very adamant about showing respect to people that they care about. The other question is, what would their last meal be if they were on death row? And it's, you know, like, for example, the example I gave was maybe they want caviar because they've been in a lower class their entire life and they want to get a taste of how the rich people live or whatever.
I've heard caviar is really salty. I've never had it myself.
Yeah, I haven't had it either. I've heard it's really salty too.
Anyway, sorry for interrupting you.
Oh, that's fine. Or, you know, something like meatloaf or something because that's what their mother cooked them. And
I love meatloaf.
Yeah, and it reminds them of better times when they were young and innocent and they had a nice family or whatever. Things like that. And then the third one is, what would their dream job be? You know, either they really like their lot in life, or maybe they want to do something else because they want to be, you know, freed from the shackles of their routine job. Or maybe they just want to... Their dream job is the same thing they're doing now, but higher in power because they aspire to be something more or something like that. So yeah, they wrote their stuff for 5 minutes as well, actually 10 minutes as well. They came up with really cool ideas also, and I was like, all right, now in a one sentence pitch, give me the main quest in your story. And they did, and I was like, all right, cool. See, it's pretty easy to write stuff, and then the story writes itself. So that was That's a fun incorrect. Little. Well, I know. But I was like, listen, just because I teach doesn't mean I know what I'm talking about, okay?
Yeah, fair. That's, well, look to all 95 episodes of our podcast.
Exactly. I have to say, though, that doing this podcast really helps teaching because even though it's difficult to talk for 2 hours, it's easier when you're used to just talking about this sort of thing regularly. So
I have an interesting question. About the course. What's the course called, sorry, when you advertise the course?
It's called Adventure Game Design.
I'm curious why you specified adventure games and didn't go with narrative design or, you know, interactive narrative design.
Because
I think you'd get more interested people.
Yeah.
Because adventure games is quite a niche.
Yeah, genre. I was thinking about that, but playcrafting has several classes taught by several people, and they already have a broader narrative design course, and there's also one that's RPG design, and so
okay,
adventure game.
Okay,
design
no, that's
is,
fair.
Yeah,
I just thought,
if you wanted
to attract more people,
yeah,
that sounds like a way.
I thought about retooling it a little bit to be more about narrative and things like that. And in fact, I actually skipped over a few of the things that I normally talk about because I was like, you know, this really doesn't matter in the design aspect of things. So, yeah, anyway, that was that. And aside from that, to just piggyback onto what I've been doing this week, as I mentioned last podcast on Wednesday, the IGDA chapter had a feedback forum, and I went to that, and I saw some pretty cool games and gave some feedback. There was someone else who was making a first-person adventure game, which looked pretty cool. Yeah, he got into the incubator program, which is pretty cool. The NYU Game Center has this thing called the Incubator Program, which basically they take students who are working on their thesis projects or games that they've made during the semester, And if they really want to finish them, they sign up for the incubator program, and it's basically an intensive course during the summer where they work on their game full time, and they just get it finished by the end of the summer.
And I suppose they're surrounded by other people, which keeps them motivated.
Exactly. And this year they did something different, which they opened up a few slots to people who were not enrolled in NYU. So that was pretty cool.
Wonderful.
So yeah, I think they only accepted about three people or so, but one of the guys was there, the guy who made that game. Yeah, it's pretty competitive. But this other game, which is being made by a friend of mine, Chris McGinnis, it's called Cognition, not to be confused with Cognition and Erica Reed.
An Erica Reed thriller. Yes. Yeah.
No, it's a mobile tap-based game, which is actually pretty cool. He showed me a demo a couple of months ago at the drink night, and I played it for a bit. You basically play as two interconnected cogs or gears or whatever, one red and one blue.
I like the name already.
Yeah. So basically it's like not really a puzzle platformer because there aren't platforms. It's kind of a top-down view of surfaces, kind of like Bad Mojo in a sense, where you're these two little gears, so you're like on desks and things and tables. Yes. And surfaces and stuff, and the obstacles are like scissors and push pins and desktop
items. That sounds a
items.
Lot like the bird's eye view of Bad Mojo. Well, it's actually not always bird's eye view because you're a roach, which means you go upside down and
right. So yeah, so you have to tap, and as you tap, the gears spin around, and that's how they move. So
yes.
You basically have to go around and navigate your way through these levels and avoid obstacles. And then there's little areas where if you go inside, the gears spin and they'll affect things in the world. Like they'll move a ruler back or something and they'll open up a path. It's really cool. And I think
I love a good pun in the title.
Yeah. Yeah. So, it's pretty cool.
Well, I say good pun.
I'm sure you'll probably I'll be able to show it to you while you're here, because we'll probably see Chris at some point, and he usually has a copy around, so you get to play it, I'm sure.
That's one cool thing about working on a mobile game, I imagine, is that if someone goes, hey, show me your game,
you
just pull out your phone.
Pretty much, or your iPad or whatever. Yeah, you just have it's pretty cool. But anyway, yeah, so that I saw that and a bunch of other games, or a couple of other games. There was one girl who was doing music who played some of her music, which was cool. There was this other guy, Craig, who's cool, who was doing music for like a Western game that was pretty cool. And of course, I showed Poe Dickens. My prologue is almost finished, and so I showed it, and I basically asked for the specific feedback of a narrative aspect of the game, which I won't talk too much about here to avoid spoiling anything.
That's fair.
But I got some really good feedback, and in fact, I have just been working on an extra scene that was suggested to me for purposes of what I wanted. And so I'm doing that today and implementing it. And hopefully my prologue's already pretty much playable from start to finish. I just need to polish it off with animations. So that's what I'm going to be working on for the next week or so. So that's me. How have you been this week?
I've been well, thank you. I've been drawing. I have just about finished the next section in the next area in Unavowed, so that's cool.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's been good playing a few games. I've had a fairly quiet week, actually. It's been I've had a nice quiet week, which has been a nice change from a fairly sort of hectic few months.
Well, that's good.
Which is good.
Yeah,
that's nice.
It's always nice to have those peaks and troughs, as you say.
Yeah, so I played a few games last week, and it was weird. I had the weekend all to myself, pretty much. I think I went out for dinner on Saturday night with a few relatives, and other than that, I just stayed home and did nothing for the first time in quite a while. So I played a few. I found some short adventure games and played through those, and just relaxed, which is nice.
Good. Well, that's if you didn't do any other extracurricular activities, that's a perfect segue into what have you been playing.
I will tell you what I've been playing. One
Please.
Thing that I've missed telling the last two times we podcast, I forget to tell you about a game called The Deadly Tower of Monsters, which I have finished.
Okay.
And I have had been playing for
May I ask a question real quick to interrupt you?
Of course.
How is it possible that you could forget to talk about a game with such a fantastic title as The Deadly Tower of Monsters?
I think when you are inundated with such copious quantity of games as I am, then it's quite easily for one soldier to fall casualty.
Yeah, but that's like saying that your soldier's name is, you know, Magnus.
The Deadly Tower of Monsters.
Magnus Skull Crusher the 15th. You know, you remember a name like that. Anyway. Sorry.
I wouldn't, because it sounds like generic fantasy tat to me.
Okay, fine.
But
it's,
yeah.
It's so hard to come up
the
with
The Deadly
names.
Tower of Monsters is a... It's not isometric, but it's not... I don't know what sort of projection it is, but it's one of those top-downy things that's not quite isometric, and it's made in the Unreal Engine. And the premise is that you are watching the DVD commentary mode of a long-forgotten B film from the 1950s, and they have the director come back, and it's I won't say cute, but it's the conceit is that he thinks he's extremely progressive and he's actually just an ass, and it's kind of interesting, but it breaks fourth, fifth and sixth walls, I think, but over the course of the game, so the writing's very much in that vein, and it's a pretty standard beat 'em up action-y game that you can just kind of kick back and not do much to. And every now and then, I mean, there's regular commentary mode. It's like Bastion, except instead of having Logan Cunningham's dulcet tones, you know, sort of telling you the narrative over the course of the game, it's just this annoying director telling you how amazing he is and how awful everyone else was. And over the course of the game, you realize just how incompetent he truly was.
That sounds like the director of Troll 2.
It's exactly like that. It's kind of like it's one of those sort of really lame films, and he's like, oh, you know, he talks about how hard, but it's kind of cute because like the aesthetic is really played fairly well. They have like stop motion animated dinosaurs that they've clearly worked hard to get video game enemies looking jerky stop motion, but that's quite cute. And they've got, you know, if you hit a rock, it deflates. And it's kind of cute stuff like that. So it was fairly fun. The ending was extremely, I don't know which wall breaking it was, but one of the walls.
I didn't realize maybe there were that many walls to break.
I didn't realize either. I think they actually built extra walls inside and then broke smashed them as soon as they'd built them. But yeah, so that was fun enough. It was really nothing to write home about, but it was just a bit of relaxed fun. It was like playing Bastion without, you know, with a less sort of unique, less unique soundtrack, less unique presentation, and probably even less unique gameplay. So it's a,
wow.
A kind of bland and silly Bastion, but it was fun enough.
That's not a very, very positive endorsement.
That's not exactly a... it's not exactly a ringing endorsement,
no,
but I had fun with it, you know. But I want to give a fair sort of comparison, and that's about as close as I can get.
Sure, that makes sense.
I think if you really like the B-movie aesthetic, you'll probably like it. You'll laugh at some of the jokes. If not laugh, you'll at least have a sort of, okay, you know, well done. but yeah. So I also played The Minims, which was a 3D adventure game, I think made in Unity, probably was. And it was very... I don't know how to sum it up because I was trying to tell someone about it. A lot of people have asked me about it because I posted a screenshot that's clearly a Loom reference.
Yeah, I saw that screenshot. You know,
so a bunch of people were asking me about it. And the only way I can sum it up is it's very slow. Mm-hmm. It's very quiet. And it's very quite simple, but I still enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's had a few things that made me laugh, but it's a pretty simple game. You know, it's pretty short. It's a couple of hours long. And it was a nice sort of, it's Friday night, kick back, just relax with a quiet little adventure game that doesn't strain your brain too hard. There's a few fun puzzles and, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I also played The Preposterous Awesomeness of Everything.
Oh, yeah. I have yet to play that, but you very kindly gifted it to me.
That's another fourth wall breaking game, but less so. Well, I will say less so. If you do the demo, if you play the demo, they're literally building the set.
Oh, okay.
And you can sort of like, you know, you can't click on certain GUI verbs because they haven't varnished them yet and things like that.
Right.
but I I found it interesting because you don't often see adventure games done in that style, and yet adventure games are so well suited to the style that it is. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of... it's a montage game where they have, like, just photos cut up.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's pretty funny, mm-hmm. but it has a sort of heart as well that you find eventually, and it's kind of social commentary. It's very silly. Yeah, it's... I think it's very well done.
Okay.
And I enjoyed it quite a lot. I gifted it to a few different people. I thought, oh, they'd enjoy this and they probably wouldn't buy it by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I thought it was quite well done and sort of it had a few fun puzzles. Yeah. I don't know what to say about it. It's really hard for me to sum up. But if you look at screenshots of it, you can immediately see why someone like me with a strange sense of humor would buy it.
Yeah.
You know, because
there's naked people in it.
And also it's kind of... it's got an interesting ending, which is very fourth wall breaking, actually. So, yeah. Mm. I also played Midwinter.
Not which, to be confused with Midwinter.
Correct.
Okay.
It was really short. That's one thing I'll say. You know, okay. They kind of it's based on this European mythology, and someone recommended it to me actually because I said, oh. I'm playing a bunch of short adventure games on Steam this weekend, and someone said, oh, play this. So I bought it and I played it. Mm. I think it took me 24 minutes.
Wow.
I was like, oh, okay. I mean, there was other stuff that I could have gone back to find, mm-hmm. but even so I went, oh, okay, that's a bit shorter than I was expecting. It's fun it's fun, but I still thought, oh, that could have been a bit more than it was, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's a very small part of what could have been a bigger narrative, I feel. So, but yeah, you sort of get to play. There was another game based in European mythology that I forget what it was that I played, and that reminded me quite a bit of this, mm-hmm. but it's sort of you're the host gnome of this farm, and you sort of protect it from one of the other mythological creatures, and there's two different ways of doing that. So that's kind of nice. But yeah, I do wish that there was more to it because it was pretty simple. Another one that I played was Dead Secret, which is a first-person horror adventure game.
Mm-hmm.
And you're sort of... It's a little bit like Gone Home, where you're in this house and you're basically rifling through people's belongings. But there's a lot less things to look at, and it's an actual horror game. So, you know, there's various points where there's a few jump scares. There's freaky things happening. You know, you can die. Mm. There's a few points in the narrative which didn't quite make sense to me. So I just had to accept that it's one of those fantasy horror games where anything weird can happen and you just put that down to it being supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
But I enjoyed it. And it's interesting, you get to the end and there's two optional hidden notes that I didn't find when I played it. Well, I found them, but I couldn't reveal them, and I forgot to reveal them until after. And if I had revealed them during the game, it would have given me a better idea. So when you get to the end, you have to find out, you know, who was the killer. It's kind of one of those mysteries. And, you know, I sort of had a less clear idea of who the killer was because I hadn't sort of done these two optional things. But it's interesting, and I enjoyed it quite a bit, and it's one of those games that I played it at, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning with the headphones on, and it's pretty creepy because of that. So yeah, okay. If you dislike creepy masks,
yes,
and being pursued by individuals wearing creepy masks and helpless, then you probably won't enjoy it very much. But that's the main.
I'm pretty desensitized to creepy masks because my mom was always into collecting creepy masks.
Your mom's got a bunch of interesting creepy masks. This is similar to that. Like, these are sort of, yeah, like that. But
okay.
Anyway, so that was fun. And the last one that I played was Rusty Lake Hotel, which I think you should play at least because it felt quite a lot like a game based on, like, Poe's works. Which, you know, I thought, oh, that might suit Francisco's interests. And you basically, the premise is that five different animals come to Rusty Lake Hotel and eat, and there are five different main courses that you have to prepare. over each night, and each night you sort of get to choose which recipe it is. And of course, each recipe corresponds to it with a different type of meat, and there are five different types of animals that come to the hotel. So you have to choose which guest
you have to kill
be served as dinner the next awful. Night. And it's interesting because it soon turns out that there's more to this, you know, that is not really, how can I put it without spoiling anything? Oh, that's horrible. Anyway, there's some fun puzzles to solve. I quite enjoyed solving the puzzles. There's some very grotesque moments.
Mm-hmm.
One particularly where you make a pig eat his own shit, and he does so repeatedly and with gusto.
My.
But yeah, it's quite an eerie game, but it has a nice art style and there's some fun puzzles, and I recommend it to you.
Okay.
Being as your
on a scale of not very Poe to very Poe, where would you put it?
It's very Poe.
Okay.
Not very Dickens.
Well, that's fine.
Yeah, so that's what I've been playing. What have you been playing?
Not too much, but I also forgot to mention something about my regular life, which is that I bought a new computer chair at IKEA. And as
now we both have new computer chairs.
Well, yes, except I still haven't taken mine out of the box. I've just been very, very lazy.
Wow.
Yeah, but I actually...
That reminds me of a comic that I saw recently.
Oh?
Let me find it for you.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, yeah, you recommended this chair, the Torkel, from IKEA.
I didn't so much recommend it as just say that I'd purchased it.
Oh, right.
And you said, oh, I'm interested in getting a new chair. I've linked you to the comic.
Yes, I see that. I think I've seen this. Oh, I did see this comic. You sent it to me and I said that it was horrifying and terrible.
It is horrifying and terrible. You're correct.
Thanks for that again.
You're welcome.
Anyway, yeah, I was going to get the Torkel, or Torkel, or however you pronounce it. And I saw it on the floor. And I on the showroom floor, and I sat in it, and I thought, oh, this is nice. But then I saw another one called the Malcolm with a K, and I sat in it, and not only were the armrests cushioned, but the back of the chair was taller, so I could lean my head back and rest it against the chair, which I couldn't do. I can't do with my current chair, and I couldn't do with the Torkel, so I got that one. It was only $5 more, so I got it. And I really should assemble it, but I've just been really lazy. Maybe I'll do it today at some point. But anyway, to get back to what I've been playing, I have not been playing much. I have, however, been playing a little bit of your favorite game series in the whole wide world. The latest entry, which is, of course, Uncharted 4. Edmundo was very kind to get me the game for my birthday as a belated birthday present, because he works at Sony, and so one of the
when
perks...
When you say belated, we're talking 5 months.
4 months ago, yeah.
But I mean, that's still very kind of him.
Well, yeah, I mean, because he was like, hey, what do you want for your birthday? And I was like, I don't know. And he's like, I work at Sony, I can get you games. And I was like, okay. And he's like, you want any games that are coming out anytime soon? I was like, Uncharted 4. He's like, okay. So then he messaged me last Friday, a week ago. And he was like, hey, do you want the version with the Nathan Drake statue, or just what the normal one? And I was like, oh, I don't want a statue. That's fine. Just give me the normal one. So I figured I was just going to get a copy of the game. But no, he actually sent me the special edition, which comes with a little nice hardcover 48-page art book and a steelbook DVD case, which is real nice.
Did it come with DLC codes?
It did not, because I don't believe that the game has any DLC upcoming.
Okay.
And anyway, Uncharted DLC is usually map packs for multiplayer, which I don't play multiplayer.
Boring.
I know. Even though apparently Sarah El Male is the voice of one of the major playable characters in the multiplayer campaign, which is pretty cool. It does come with stickers though, which is nice.
That's cool.
I haven't opened them, but it seems to be mostly just like Naughty Dog logos and pirate flags and stuff, which is kind of cool.
Fair enough.
But anyway, I started playing Uncharted 4. And I've really played very little of it, because I was trying to be responsible and save it for the weekend, but it's looking like this weekend might be a little, well, not super busy, but I'm probably going to be spending most of tomorrow watching Eurovision with friends, so I might not get it. Yeah, I know.
don't know if that's better than Uncharted 4, I gotta say.
Yeah, well, I mean, as an excuse to hang out with friends and just have a laugh and, you know, hang out and have a good time, I think it's a better use of my time than sitting alone playing Uncharted 4. But, yeah, I mean, I've played about the first 1.5 chapters of it, and so far it's, you know, it's a standard Uncharted game. But I see, yeah. I mean, it's a lot prettier, that's for sure. You know,
yeah, the screenshots that I've seen have looked wonderful. It's amazing how much work goes into a single area in these games.
Yeah, and I haven't had to do much shooting. I mean, the game opened up sort of in media res, as these Uncharted games like to do sometimes.
Yes.
Where you're driving a speedboat and you have to, you know, it's a tutorial thing where it's like, oh, press these buttons to move, press these buttons to shoot, that sort of thing. And yeah, you have to shoot a couple of guys, but it's not unfair or anything. And then you basically start the first chapter playing as Nathan Drake as a little boy in the orphanage, and you get more of his backstory.
Is he an awful little boy? Because he's an awful adult.
I mean, not really. What little boy isn't awful, though?
I kind of wish that the childhood scene is just like the rest of the game, and he just murders 250 nuns per level.
No, he basically has to sneak around and not get caught by the nun in the game in this bit. But it's cool because, like, you can interact with the environment. You can, like, read his file and stuff, and then his brother shows up, and it introduces the grappling hook mechanic, which I'm sure is going to be a major component of the gameplay, which is fine because I like grappling hooks. They're fun. So yeah, it's been fun. And then the second level starts off in a Panamanian prison, and Nathan is a little bit, he's an adult, but he's slightly younger than he has been. I'm pretty sure this
What's he in prison for?
I don't know. I haven't found out.
If it's not multiple counts of murder, then
I think it's meant to take place either before the first Uncharted or fairly early in his career, because he looks younger. Like, he still looks like Drake, but he looks younger than he did in Uncharted 1. So the gist of it,
I think it'd be funny if that, like, the Uncharted 4 was just he'd been put in prison for, like, you know, 4,000 murders.
Yeah, it would be pretty funny.
And he had to, why did you do it, Nathan Drake? They had treasure. Yeah, I wanted it.
Pretty much. Well, I mean, it starts off you're in, like, a fist fight, so it's kind of like a melee combat tutorial thing.
That was my favorite part.
Yeah.
The melee combat.
Yeah, and then you get taken around by this guard who's working for you, and, like, it's funny because all the guards are speaking in Spanish and saying all these things, and Nathan's like, I speak a little Spanish. What was it you said? But I understand what they all say, so it's kind of
amazing. I would hope so.
I would hope so, too. But anyway, they get to this tower, and the guy's like, I want in on this treasure when you find the treasure in the tower. And at that point, I was like, okay, this is enough Uncharted 4 for tonight. I need to go to bed. So that's where I left off. So the story hasn't really picked up at all, but so far it's intriguing and I like it. And, you know, from the screenshots I've seen and the clips I've seen, it looks very nice, and I'm sure I'll enjoy it. There's this great clip that's going around. I don't know if you've seen it, of the Jeep falling off of the cliff.
I haven't seen it.
No. Oh, well, there's
I
a
don't
level...
really seek out Uncharted footage.
Well, yeah. Someone has been, I've seen the tweet going around where it's like, oh, this makes me laugh every time. And they're basically like, the story starts off, or the chapter starts off, and they're driving in the Jeep. And Sully's like, all right, we need to find this thing. And Nathan's like, well, yeah, we did. And then halfway mid-sentence, they just drive off a cliff, and you get the death screen. And it's just like, ah, which is pretty funny. Anyway, okay. Yeah.
I'm sure it's hilarious. You probably need to see it.
You definitely do need to see it. Yeah. But, so well, yeah.
It's such a forceful word.
I know that you hate the Uncharted series, and you hate Uncharted 2.
My main problem is that if you're going to make a, you know, series based on shooting, you should actually have enjoyable shooting mechanics.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've always been willing to give it the benefit of the doubt. I didn't have a problem too much with the shooting mechanics as you did.
Yeah, but you like that modern cover style
of
shooting.
Yeah, I do, admittedly. But judging
you like
from what I've...
hiding behind boxes and playing Pop-a-Mole, as the RPG Codex calls it.
judging from what I've seen so far, I think that they've taken a lot of influence from the narrative design of The Last of Us, which makes sense because Neil Druckmann was the lead designer or creative director or whatever on both projects. So, yeah, I think that having a more, and from what I've heard, there's even more stealth-based stuff than there was in Uncharted 3, which I thought was a step in the right direction because you can definitely use stealth a lot more effectively in Uncharted 3. So yeah, I'm eager to play more of it, and I'm excited to do it. And I'm also kind of hesitant because I know that after I play the game, there won't be any more Uncharted. So I'm kind of sad that.
What a loss.
Yeah, exactly. Also, I'm really curious how it'll end because the game is called A Thief's End. So I'm guessing that either Drake or his brother will probably die at the end, but we'll see.
Technically, if it's Drake and his brother, surely it's just Drake or Drake.
Well, Drake isn't his actual surname, so spoiler alert. Anyway.
Shows you how much Uncharted attention I've paid.
Well, they don't really get into that until the third game, really, so.
Well, I'll never know.
No, that's a shame. That's a shame. You really shouldn't cut yourself off.
Why? Just,
I don't know, because, you know, we've had this discussion. We don't need to bring it up on the podcast.
I like good shooting mechanics, and I can't get past bad shooting mechanics.
That's
and fine. I can't get past annoying characters. So
well, yeah, but I mean, you know, each game is a different
I know they're experience. Your friends. I'm sorry that I'm picking on them.
Well, no, but I mean, you know, you've played different. Surely you've played different games in a series, and you've said, "Oh, well, this one is not as good." Look at Monkey Island. Sure,
Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah, look at Monkey Island. For example.
Oh yeah, everybody's got their favorite Monkey Island game. And it's universally different.
Yeah, every Monkey Island game is different in tone, in style, in lots of things. But, you know. So that's like saying, "Oh, I didn't like Monkey Island 2, I'm never playing another Monkey Island game again."
Well, it depends what you didn't like about it. For me, there's just so many other games that don't do what Uncharted does that I'm like, I'd be wasting a lot of money on playing Uncharted more than I have, you know, another two games to buy, another three games if I got the one for Vita. No, it's just, that's not my thing.
That's fair. That's fine. Anyway, yes, that's what I've been playing. So, let's move on to this week's topic.
Let's do it.
Right.
This is one that you suggested, Francisco.
This is one that I suggested, Ben. So the topic this week is self-censorship, or I guess more specifically, how to know when to draw the line between good taste as far as if you put stuff that may be considered controversial in your game. One of the advantages of making independent adventure games is that a lot of the times you don't really have to worry about mainstream publishers telling you, no, don't put this in, or, you know. At least, like, with my experience with Wajedi, Dave has always been very open to ideas, and he's never told me, oh, you should take this out of your game because whatever. Except for recently, actually, when he a little aspect of Poe Dickens that he suggested changing because it might come off wrong. And I said, yeah, that's a good point. But anyway, for the most part, you know, when working with these sorts of things, you have free rein to do what you like, and you know, it's nice to have mature subjects in adventure games because it's a good platform.
It's also nice to be able to have immature subjects in adventure games.
Oh, well, that too. Yeah, of course. You can make
even an immature take on what people might think is a mature subject, you know.
Sure.
Is still enjoyable.
Right, but I mean, my point is, like, it's, you know, you can swear in adventure games. You can deal with topics that are difficult subjects, like, you know.
I mean, has there been any calls to remove sort of foul language from your games?
No, never.
No, that's what I thought.
But then again, I don't really use foul language very much in my games.
Okay.
I mean, but anyway, the broad topic before we get into specifics here is just controversial subjects in games and how do you know, or at least tips on figuring out what the best way to portray them is and whether they're appropriate or whether they're just being put in for shock value and that sort of thing.
Do you wanna just have a quick like summary of what you consider to be controversial things to put in a game?
Sure. I guess controversial things to put in a game would be topics like, you know, murder or rape.
I don't think that murder is controversial in games, considering...
That's true. I guess more controversial in adventure games would be stuff like, you know, rape or abortion or suicide or, incest or things like that, you know?
Okay.
What about
things like nudity? What about things like showing racism?
Yeah, nudity, racism, homophobia, explicit sex and things like that. That sort of thing.
Okay.
All those sorts of things. Now, I have not portrayed too many of these topics in games that I've made. I was thinking back on some of the games that I've worked on and the games I've made, and just working from most recent to backwards, Shardlight had several things like the topic of assisted suicide, at least in the sense of like mercy killing, and also, you know, just like in the quarantine zone, you have people who have basically hanged themselves to escape from the terribleness of the quarantine zone. I've worked on games with, you know, I've put nudity in my games, like A Golden Wake, although it was, you know, not anything super graphic or anything.
You had 7 pixels.
That's to true. Work with, let's that's face true. It. Exactly. Same with Backdoorman. Backdoorman had full frontal nudity, full frontal male nudity. It had
flappy breasts on an old granny.
Yeah.
Which is one of my favorite moments of the game.
And it also had pixelated male nudity with full walk cycles for all 4 directions.
Your games have that for every character.
Well, that's true, but very few of them have... The Backdoor Man's the only game that I've had with a fully nude walk cycle. Okay. So, yeah. And, you know, I've talked about... I've done... I'm trying to think if I've done anything else. Well, I mean, Backdoor Man dealt with male prostitution, which is fairly mature in its subject matter. So yeah, I mean, and I'm thinking of games you've worked on, I immediately think of Piss.
I mean, I come from a background of making games like Piss. Yeah. And if we're talking about censoring oneself, I've never been super willing to censor myself. You know, I've given games ridiculous titles, I've had ridiculous settings, ridiculous characters. I've really gone with whatever the hell idea I've wanted.
Yeah.
You know, Piss starts off with the sound of one of my friends peeing.
Yeah.
For a long time, and
he's
I said,
my
to him,
friend
you know,
too,
it's got
you
a,
know.
It's got to sound like the longest piss anyone's ever done, sort of thing. I think it took him 3 goes to get one long enough to satisfy me. Wow. So I come from a background like, you know, in Techno Babylon. I don't think I ever made it in the game, but I animated a graphic suicide. I animated death. You know, a lot of death. I animated, you know, nudity, small nudity. It's funny, the nudity is so small that Dave didn't even know it was there, and I said, oh yeah, you know, I drew a little tiny penis.
Techno Babylon.
And yeah, he was like, oh, what?
Techno Babylon is a good game to talk about, I think, because even though I still have yet to play it, you are more familiar with it than I am, and you would know because you did the graphics for it. So you know.
I am pretty familiar with it.
You're pretty familiar with it, I'd say.
Yeah. Although, I think, you know, if you look at Shardlight, I animated quite a lot of violence.
Yeah. But I mean, Techno Babylon deals with a lot of complex and mature themes as well, like, you know,
definitely.
Suicide.
Yeah. You know, I mean, you have suicide, you have
cannibalism,
sort of. Yeah, and like, just you're a detective, and the things you see are the sort of things that a detective would see.
Right.
So yeah, you're a detective for some of it, but yeah, that's one thing, and I guess the thing to my mind about thinking about these things is the first question to me is, why are you doing it?
Yeah, exactly.
To me, that's the most important thing. Why do you need to do this? Why do you need to put that in the game? And I should also clarify that I should, you know, that I also think that sometimes you don't need a reason.
Mm-hmm.
I think that depends on the issue in particular, but I think you should always keep in mind, what is this adding to your game? What does it add to the experience? What does it bring to the experience? If you're just throwing in, you know, bad language, because it's funny, I remember a guy that I know got Grand Theft Auto 5, and he was telling me that he had bought Grand Theft Auto 5, and his sort of summary of the game was, oh man, it's so cool, there's so much swearing in it. And I went, what?
Yeah.
How does that improve the experience? It doesn't, you know.
No, it really doesn't.
It fits the characters, I suppose, but I just sort of, that, to me, nudity, graphic depictions of violence, you know, sexual content, bad language, those aren't things that I would buy a game for.
Mm-hmm.
They're not things I'd buy a game for specifically. They're things I don't mind being part of the experience. And it comes back to the old thing, is as long as you do it tastefully and as long as you do it well and thoughtfully.
Right, but that's sort of what we're exploring here.
How do you define... What's that, sorry?
I said that's sort of what we're exploring here, is what exactly is good taste and what exactly is done well.
I think one interesting thing, and I'm going to talk about Techno Babylon here. Something that I really admired about the game.
Techno Babishlong. That's the porn version.
No, it's not.
Anyway.
It is not. Anyway. One of the characters in Techno Babylon, and this is going to be a spoiler, is a trans woman.
Right.
And you uncover her story. It's very much sidelined. There's very... It's quite a small thing. And one thing that I really liked about this is that James didn't push it down your throat.
Right.
Is that he's not going, look how progressive my game is.
Right.
You know, he just, that's who she is.
Right.
And he didn't make a big deal out of it. He made it part of her character. But it is not what defines her as a character. You know, sometimes you have a character and this is, you know, they'll have a character that's gay, or they'll have a character that's one of those, you know, characters that is sort of progressive, in that you don't see them a lot in games, and they're sort of including a more diverse range of characters in the game, but that's who they are as a character.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's very unfortunate, because there's a lot more to someone than that side of things. You know, that doesn't define who, they shouldn't define who they are as a character any more than the, you know, their race or their age or their, you know, social class. So I really admired the fact that not a big deal was made out of that, and, you know, it wasn't used as a sort of, oh, look how diverse we are, look how progressive we are. It was just how that character was. To me, that's the best take, that's the best possible way you can put that. And of course I'm biased because I worked on it, but, you know, it's great to have a sort of character that can be so much more than a sort of, you know, part of a diverse cast. Because it is unfortunate when you see, you know, the token person of this race or the token person of this personality, and you think, well, that's who they are. Sure. I wish they had more character.
Sure.
So I also think sometimes when it comes to violence, depictions of violence, it really depends on the world. In Shardlight, I really didn't mind doing sort of graphic depictions of violence, because when you look at the setting, it is a world that has been torn by war. It's a world that has been torn by plague. It's a world that is ruled by a government with an iron fist.
Mm-hmm.
Having graphic violence in a game like that is quite okay to my mind. You know, people are like, oh man, that's such a graphic animation. Yes. It's a horrible world. I want you to see that.
But even still, like, Amy's really the only person in this game that we see committing these horrible acts of violence. But then again, it's because story.
We have the government stretching one person that I won't name out on a rack.
That's true.
So, I think for me, you know, there's a beheading in the game that's not done by her. And
that's true.
I added the beheading in because I think at low resolution, you know, this isn't a sword fight. At low resolution, it's quite hard to appreciate, you know, you can't make people act very easily. I can't anyway. You can't make them act pain. You can't make them horror.
Right.
So to convey it, you kind of, I call it low res vaudeville, where you kind of go over the top and you show way more than it should be, so because you're playing to the back of the room because the pictures are so small.
Yeah, in this case, you could call it low res grand guignol.
Yeah, so there's this. I added this beheading in just because I wanted to show, you know, this is serious.
Yeah, and this character is now showing their true colors because that's sort of the whole point of that scene. So, yeah.
So there's other fights in the game, and none of those kind of go to that extent because there was no, you know, that's not how the other characters act. But this character in particular, when I read the script and I sort of knew who she was, I went, she's got to do more than just kill a person. She has to kill him in a way that the audience goes, oh man, what the hell?
Right, yeah.
So to me, there was a purpose behind adding that beheading.
Yeah.
I didn't put it in because, well, part of me, and also part of me, I wanted to do a cool animation.
Yeah, of course.
You know, and,
sure.
And I think that's okay.
Yeah.
To an extent. You know, I wanted to do a cool animation and I found a place that fits it. And I found a game that fits it. I used to freak out a little bit, you know, take Jagged Alliance 2, for example. When I used to play that, as you know, I would have been 12 years old or 11 years old, I used to play that, and you kind of, you know, you shoot a guy in the head and his head explodes and a shower of gore comes flying out of his neck and he, like, you know, he crumples over. And when you come back later, there's these decaying corpses that ravens pick at, and it's kind of gross like that. But you're playing in this horrible setting and it kind of, they want to show the reality of what you're doing, I think.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think you can be a bit desensitized to it. I remember Fallout 3 seeming really, really violent when I first played it. I was like, because Fallout has always been violent. But Fallout 3, I went, oh, man, there's just chunks of meat everywhere.
Yeah, literally, that's...
There's chunks of meat everywhere in this world. Yeah, I felt the same way. And, yeah, I wasn't quite sure about that. But then, like, you know, it's a post-apocalyptic setting.
Sure.
It's I think the horrors of a post-apocalyptic setting can also be conveyed well in writing, but I don't think there's a reason why you shouldn't try and convey them in art as well.
Yeah.
So,
well, going back again, a bit
that to, comes down to the setting.
Yeah, of course. Going back a bit to what you said about the dealing with, for example, the trans character in Technobabylon. I think it's tricky to find a balance too, because ultimately, like you said, James treated it as a very minor thing. It's not a huge part of her character. And you could argue that having the conversation about it really, I mean, it serves the purpose of revealing that aspect of the character, but if, and it's completely optional. So you could play the whole game and not know that this character was a trans woman. But it's there. So I guess my question is, why, what purpose does it serve to put in aside from just that little bit of character development? Like, from a purely...
That's who she is.
Right, right. You know? But I just mean from like a gameplay point of view, you know? Because you were talking...
It doesn't add anything.
I know. Okay. Get me wrong. Let me clarify. I'm not saying that it shouldn't be in there. I'm just questioning... Yeah. I'm just asking as a specific question, like, what does it add? What does it detract by not having it in there? What does it add by having it in there, you know?
Okay, there's two things that I'll talk about. The first thing I want to say is also that after this character had been written, Dave sought some feedback
from
some people that had, you know, experience. And could sort of give firsthand experience and feedback, which I think helps a lot if you're writing someone like that. You know, if you're going to write someone, say, the victim of child abuse, and you don't, and you're just making stuff up without reading accounts of things like that, you know, you really probably are going to not do it the service that you could have done it.
Right.
You know, you talked about, I don't want to spoil too many things, but you talked about some things that you were looking at doing for your next game, and I said you should read The Kitchen God's Wife,
right,
and just sort of get a first-hand account of how that can happen, the true horror of it, and you know, maybe the book will leave you in tears as it did me, but at least you get a bit of an idea more than, oh, this is a bad thing that the news says is bad, and we all know it's bad, so, you know, I can talk about it. And I think that helped. In this case, firstly, I don't know that it's completely sensible to look at something like that in a case of what does it add, what does it detract. I used to get picked on a little bit for writing homosexual characters in my games,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is interesting because I never wrote a lot of them. But when you write one or two and there's not many of them in games, people sort of really pick on that. You're like, oh, you're the guy. It makes me laugh. Someone asked me once, you know, why are all your main characters women? And at that point, I think I'd done 5 games with female main characters and 7 games with male main characters.
Mm-hmm.
But because you don't, people don't write women in lead roles that much. Yeah, well, I mean, they do, but you know, it really stood out to them. And I sort of said, you know, well, actually, you know, of the games I worked on. And I get that the most popular ones have been women.
Yeah.
But to me, you know, I still put a lot of time into all those games and I care about all of them, you know.
Yeah.
But I don't think, you know, the point of putting sort of, you know, a homosexual character in a game, I'm not putting them in there for a reason. I'm putting them in there because those people exist, and I want
sure.
and those people exist in the world around me, and you just write worlds to be like the world around you.
Right. Well, I mean,
you know, and
the thing I want to get at is, like, I don't think anyone has picked, like, I guess I can spoil it. There's a pretty major character in Shardlight who is gay, and in writing this character, we both agreed that, yeah, sure, that can be who this character is. But there's really the sort of backstory we came up for it is never really explained in the game, so I don't think anyone has picked up on the fact that this character is gay.
And I don't think a lot of times it doesn't matter.
Exactly. That's the thing. That's kind of what I was asking about as far as, like, the trans character in Technobabylon. Like, okay, one very important character in Shardlight is gay, but it doesn't really matter because that's not part of the story at all.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. But, you know, no one would know from playing the game, really. But, yeah, so it's kind of like, well, so why did we do it? Well, because we did it. You know, does that make any sense?
Yeah, it's one of those things. Homosexuality,
I mean, we're not,
in a character never requires justification.
Exactly. We're not trying to say, "Ooh, look at us. We made this character gay." Like, "Oh, did you pick up on it?" You know, it's because no, that's not what it is. That's just for our frame of reference. That's just whatever. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. Anyway,
yeah, it's one of those things that currently we're making a deal out of it, but when it comes to actually implementing it and putting it in the thing, there's really nothing to it, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
If you write a relationship between two people, you're still writing a relationship between two people. They're
right.
Both human beings. That's, mm-hmm. You know, relationships follow fairly set formats. You know, obviously the actual physical interactions and the social implications in certain settings of two characters interacting in a homosexual relationship versus a heterosexual relationship are different.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to implementing it and you have control, there's really little difference to it. I've been watching Northern Exposure recently,
that's
set in the 90s, right?
Yeah.
And it's interesting because you have a sort of, there's a gay couple and there's a character that really doesn't like the fact that they're gay.
Mm-hmm.
That's who he is. And, you know, and he's shown, I think this is important too, and he's shown to be a bad character. Like, he's not doing it in, like, you know, it's easy to pass off homophobia as comedy. We've mm-hmm. all seen that.
Sure.
But this isn't done for that reason. This is saying, yeah, you know, this awful guy, here's another reason that he's awful.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to show bigotry in your game, I think you have to show it in a way that you know and the players know that, you know, bigotry is wrong. And right. I think that's important. Otherwise, it's easy to get your tone mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's interesting because there's this game called Bulletstorm. It's a first-person shooter called People Can Fly. And it tries to be progressive in that it has it has an awful character.
Mm-hmm.
And he throws racial slurs around, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, you know, and people go, hey, you know, hang on, this isn't quite right. And eventually this character kind of meets his end in an awful way, which is a spoiler for Bulletstorm, but seriously, it's Bulletstorm. You know, and when I played the game, I thought, oh, this is, you know, this is interesting that they've put this character in and they've done these things. But someone pointed out to me a while ago after playing it, and they said, oh, the first time I played Bulletstorm, I thought it was quite clever. But the second time I played it, I thought these people just wanted to write these awful jokes.
Yeah.
And then and just put it in their game, and they got away with it by saying, oh, he's a bad guy. So there's, it's a very fine line.
Right.
You know, it's a very fine line between, you know, oh, you did a clever thing or you did a progressive thing. It doesn't even feel like progressive to be accepting of race or homosexuality now, because it's, they're so, they're,
yeah.
I mean, they're not issues of the past, but they really feel like they should be. Media and the world and society have covered these things enough. It's hard to believe that they're still issues, but they are.
Yeah.
Well, also, to
go back, not to derail your thing, but it goes back to what we were talking about earlier about swearing. I mean, you know, we've discussed, you and I, about how swearing is one of those things, like anything, that if you do it too much can feel really forced. And it's definitely one of those things that you can put in your game to say, oh, look, I'm swearing because I can swear. Which, you mentioned Grand Theft Auto, and that's, I've mentioned this as an example before, too, the difference between Vice City and San Andreas. And, you know, Vice City came out in 2001. San Andreas, I believe, came out in 2004. And in that four-year span, I mean, there had been swearing in games before, but you just, it wasn't done to the extent of almost parody that it was done in San Andreas. And I remember, like, because, you know, Vice City was kind of, I don't want to say strange that it didn't have swearing, but if you think about it, comparing it to the types of movies that it was obviously paying homage to, like Scarface and Goodfellas and all that stuff, those movies are like, you know, they say fuck like once every 2 seconds, basically. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was plenty of other swearing in Vice City, but they didn't say fuck or any sort of variety of fuck. And in San Andreas, that's all they say. They say the N-word a lot because, you know, it's a gang, urban quote-unquote gang setting.
Urban.
What's that?
Urban. Yeah, urban.
I did air quotes. You couldn't see, okay. But I did air quotes.
I see.
Yeah, because that's a stupid adjective, but whatever.
Yes.
It was kind of shocking in a way that it seemed like it was done gratuitously because it just, they were like, okay, well, we can swear now. Let's swear like crazy. I remember when I played Gabriel Knight, the first Gabriel Knight, back in like the mid or late 90s when I got it. And it was rated T for teen because at that point the ESRB had become a thing. And I don't remember what the exact, you know, qualifiers for why it was rated T for teen were, but I think it might have been like language or whatever. But I mean, they say fucking Gabriel Knight a few times, and I was like, wow, I think that was the first time I'd ever heard anyone say it in an adventure game, and especially like in a Sierra adventure game.
Yeah, which are often like family friendly.
Exactly. Even Leisure Suit Larry, which is, you know, a raunchy sex comedy, never really swears. It wasn't until the awful Magna Cum Laude, which was basically
not really... I paid no attention to that.
Yeah, I played it, and it was unfortunate. I forced myself to play the whole thing, and it was really, really, really bad. Like,
yeah, so I've heard.
And it didn't even... and made worse by the fact that they added swearing to it, so it's like, you know, the opening scene... You know, little Larry Lovage is in his dorm room and he's like, I'm going to go and have, and I'm going to make myself. And like through the wall, you hear someone says, hey, we're trying to fuck in here. And he's like, oh, I am too. And then he goes out and starts his adventure. And there's a really horrible scene later on, which is actually quite disturbing, where he dresses up as the school mascot, which is like a log named Twiggy. And he seduces this insane band leader girl. And as they're having sex, she's like, fuck me, Twiggy! And just saying all these horrible things, which are played for laughs, but are really awful. And it added absolutely nothing to the game. It detracted from the game. It was ridiculous. And, yeah, swearing like anything else, if it's done well. Like in Shardlight, again, not to go back to Shardlight, but there's only one... We say fuck twice in Shardlight, and it's completely optional. It's in...
I said it a lot more while making it.
Well, so did I. But I mean, in the in-game dialogue, there's only one character who says fuck, and it's completely optional. It's the character in question who's on the rack. And obviously, I mean, the character's being stretched out on the rack, and if you let the scene play out, the character will say fuck you to the person who is torturing him. Which completely makes sense within the context, I would think. Because
it's weird, because if I was in the world of Shardlight, for real, I'd be saying a lot more.
Yeah. You
know? But when, it's hard. I also think one thing you brought up Leisure Suit Larry. Is it Leisure Suit Larry 3 that starts off with like a disclaimer like, oh, if you get easily offended by jokes about gender and jokes about race, then this is the wrong game for you.
Yeah.
I'm like, to me, if you need to make jokes about stuff like that, okay, you know, if you got to do it, go on, you know. But for me, first of all, don't be all high and mighty or sensitive about it if people get offended.
Yeah.
Because you know what you're doing if you put that stuff in a game.
Sure.
Especially now. And secondly, to me, if you need that to be funny in your game, then maybe you shouldn't try writing comedy.
Yeah.
If that's what you need, if you need that shit in your game to be funny, if that's the thing, the pedestal on which your jokes all rely to be seen, then I think you're in the wrong job or the wrong genre.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And, I mean, basically, the swearing thing is just, if it fits the tone and it fits the characters, there's no reason not to, because people swear in real life, and it's kind of two extremes. It's kind of like, if you're in a situation where it makes sense for someone to swear and they don't, it kind of feels strange. But then if you are also in a situation where someone just randomly swears and it feels forced,
I think another important thing, and another thing to also say, is that sometimes people try and get around swearing with alternatives. And if that suits the character, then that's fine. But if not, then that always sounds ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can also play to the advantage of maybe your character is an awkward teenager who wants to fit in with the adults, and so they swear just to sound, because they think it sounds more adult
or something. Yeah, if you know what you're doing with it, then that's okay. If you, I don't know. I always think I don't know. It does always catch my ear if I hear swearing in an adventure game. I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
You know, even mild swearing, I'm like, interesting. I don't know why.
Well, maybe I mean, look at Dreamfall Chapters. There's a character in Dreamfall Chapters who swears comically, and they got a lot of flack because not only did she swear a lot, but she also used.
Well, from what I remember, she made ableist comments, right?
Yes, she did.
Oh, that's so... See, any of that stuff is so hard to gauge.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to gauge the intent. And as a writer, and I know this is something that you do, as a writer you want to be subtle and sort of get things across, but there's some things that if you're too subtle with... I'm not saying this is the case in Dreamfall Chapters, but this is what it seemed like to me. I haven't played it, you know. Sometimes if you're too subtle and don't communicate your intent clearly enough, it's very easy... It's very easy to make a decision when you hear something the first time.
Yeah.
And especially if you're offended by it, you make your decision very quickly, what we call a knee-jerk reaction.
Yeah.
And that's not a wrong thing to do. That's just how it happens. And if the author hasn't communicated clearly enough to you what they're trying to go for, then maybe there's some things that you need to over-explain just a little bit, just to make sure that, you know, people go, oh, that's what's happening here.
Yeah. Because, I mean, she makes these comments to this character who is, as odd as it sounds, they're not really terms of endearment, but the relationship she has with the character is, it's basically like her adoptive brother, I think, and he's this big silent guy who doesn't talk, and I think the explanation is that he's autistic or something like that. He's basically a high level functioning autistic mute or something like that. I don't remember exactly because it's been such a long time since I played the first chapter. But anyway, she basically like starts yelling at him and saying all this stuff. But like it's explained that she cares for him and she likes him and she loves him, but she still yells all these horrible things at him. So yeah, I don't know.
I think to me that's something that you should. Here's the thing: relationships establish over time and they develop over time,
right?
And if you said that to somebody the first time you met them,
yes, exactly,
the result would be very different. What you have to remember as a writer is this is the first time we're meeting these people,
right? Well, that so this is the first time that we as the player are meeting these people. Obviously, if it shows that the character is comfortable enough with the player character to say these things in front of them, then yes.
Yeah, but I mean,
but there is
yeah,
that
but
disconnect
this, but even between, as a even yeah. taking it away from the player character to the audience themselves,
right?
To us as a player, this is the first time we're meeting that person.
Yeah.
So you have to make a first impression that is in line with what you want. And if you want them to be a lovable character
yeah.
and they're shouting, you know, ableist slurs at somebody, that's not going to make a good first impression.
Right.
You're not yeah. really going to give them a chance to redeem themselves if you've already made that judgment.
But that just
based on that first impression.
That just plays to what I was saying about the disconnect between player and audience, or player character and audience, which that's the tricky thing. So like if you have, you know, if you have a character who, you know, their best friend comes over or whatever, and their best friend starts by saying, "Hey, fuckface, what's up?" You know, that's I guess that in that case that's a little easier to do because it's easier to sort of portray that like wacky best friend archetype.
Yeah, to a point.
To a point. But,
I do think if
but
you
it's
want to
true,
make a
yeah.
good first impression.
Right.
You know.
But that's a tricky thing, is making a first impression to a character that the audience is getting a first impression to, but that the player's first impression of was ages ago, you know?
Yeah, but we are writing these stories for the benefit of the audience, not
right.
for the benefit of that character. So they're
sure.
the ones to sort of keep in mind, you know. Yeah. It's interesting, I mentioned to you a while ago, you know, I was talking about Northern Exposure again, and
yes.
I was sort of saying about, you know, I don't trust this character, or, you know, and you said, oh, that's so weird to use terms of trust. But to me, it really is a trust situation where if somebody does something wrong and it's the first time I've met them, I'm like, oh, dude, what an asshole. If someone does something wrong and I've already seen over two or three episodes that they're a good person,
mm-hmm.
maybe I have a bit more trust that they're going to be able to redeem themselves,
mm-hmm.
you know, and maybe I've got a bit more trust in the writers after seeing 19 episodes that they're going to be able to bring this back from what is an awful situation. And I go, oh, that's no, dude, don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, they earn your trust. And as Northern Exposure gets on, you know, it gets wackier and weirder and weirder and weirder. And, you know, some of the episodes, if I'd seen those episodes early on, I would have gone, oh, this show's not for me.
Mm-hmm.
Halfway through, without giving the writers a chance to resolve it. But because they had sort of, you know, they start off slowly and then hit their stride in terms of wackiness, I'm like, okay, they've always saved it before. I'll give them another chance. You know, let's see what happens this time. If you do that straight away, if that's how you open with, people are going to take a minute to adjust to it. You know, you got to give the players time to adjust, I think. Well, you don't have to, but I think that helps.
Yeah, definitely.
Building a good first impression. Before you show somebody being an asshole, if you want them to be a likable character, before you show their mistake, show that you can trust this person
yeah.
most of the time. It's just, you know, we all make mistakes.
Sure.
That's what I think, you know. And again, I don't think you have to do any of this stuff. It's a creative medium.
Mm-hmm.
Do what you want. But these are things that will help people stomach. If you really got to do that stuff, this will help it,
yeah.
I think.
Well, what another thing I wanted to talk about was the subject of sex and nudity. More, not so much sex, because I haven't really done many games with sex in them. Like, Backdoor Man was about a male prostitute, but you never actually saw any graphic sexual encounters. And in A Golden Wake, you know, there was a post-coital scene, but there was no, you know. Someone made a joke to me about the other day about rotoscoping, and they were like, oh, just wait until you have a sex scene in your game. And I was like, haha, that's funny. But the thing with nudity is, it's tricky too, because, like, there's a whole slew of games that feature nudity, and the majority of this nudity is female nudity. And I remember having a conversation a long time ago with Eric Fierstein, Eric, Mr. Colossal Fierstein. He was making this pretty cool game back in the early 2000s called, I don't remember actually, but, it was really cool. It was like, it wasn't really medieval, but it was set in like this sort of, jungle desert area. And you were this guy and like walking around and talking to villagers and things like that. And there was a bit where you went underground and there was these underground, like, mole type people who were naked. And he showed me an animation of one's idle animation where he was just kind of standing there, kind of, you know, breathing or bobbing up and down, like sub-pixel animation type stuff that characters in idle animations sometimes do. And he was naked, and he was obviously a male because he had little dangling genitalia that wiggled along with his idle bob. And he said to me, I gave this guy a penis, and I am making it move while he's idle because I know that that's going to make people uncomfortable, certain people uncomfortable, and I want them to feel uncomfortable because I don't think that enough people do this. And I was like, that works. That's a valid reason, I think. That's amusing. And I've actually taken that to heart. Because, I mean, I've had nudity in some of my games. In Ben Jordan 6, there was a very pixelated, topless female creature. But I've also had male nudity. I've had, you know, as I mentioned, been Backdoor Man and in A Golden Wake. And I am going to feature, again, male nudity, male full frontal nudity in my next game. But I'm doing it in a very natural and tasteful way. I don't want to spoil what it is because it's, you know, it's not a huge plot spoiler or anything, but I'm pleased with the way that I've managed to sort of incorporate it. So yeah, I mean, you know, and you've done pretty graphic.
I've written a sex scene.
Yeah, you've had a pretty graphic.
Which is like writing nothing else, I promise you. That's a whole new thing. And
my babies. Sorry.
It's important to me when I was doing that is to think, why am I doing this?
Yeah.
A lot of times nudity in media is done for titillation, you know, is done for people like looking at human bodies. So
well, I can tell you one thing, doing nudity in low res pixelation is usually not done for titillation because it's really difficult to.
But people get nudity is a weird thing.
Yeah, I know.
I want to say that, you know, I'm not saying that that's why people go for it, but you know, people, and I think it's important to remember that there's two different contexts to consider this stuff in and to have sensitivity towards both. Mm-hmm. The first is that yes, your setting may be very different to this world that we're living in, you know. But also, yes, you should be sensitive to the cultural and social context that your audience is coming from. It's a two-part equation.
Yeah.
You've got nudity that is an everyday thing, you know. We've got, our lives are filled with nudity. We walk around in human skin with flesh. We have these things in our life. Every day you see yourself naked when you wash. But
not if you close your eyes and cry like I do.
But why are you showing it?
Yeah.
Because you don't show the characters going to the toilet, and you do that every day. And you don't show them collecting their mail. You don't show them visiting their mother.
You do if you're a David Cage game. Why are you choosing
to show it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, David Cage has gotten flack for his games where the characters, it seems like it's gratuitous shower scenes in some cases.
Well, it's the imbalance.
Well, Heavy Rain was actually balanced because you had Ethan taking a shower. Well,
yeah, but you look at
it was the portrayal of it.
You look at the mechanisms and the camera movements and the focuses when you, and there's still imbalance.
Yeah. No, of course.
Very much so. Right.
There was a huge portrayal. Like Madison's shower scene was meant to be, it was definitely presented in a much more, I guess, erotic and titillating way.
Yeah.
Than Ethan's absolutely shower scene was. Yes.
Yeah, if you had, think about it this way, if you had a male in the shower doing, like if you had Ethan in the shower doing the sort of things that she does while she's in the shower, you'd go, that looks ridiculous.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, and it's the same with outfits. You have sometimes people do like gender swap outfits.
Yeah.
And the thing, and how ridiculous that some of these
outfits look. Yeah, you have like boob
armor and midriff. Because we're so used to seeing that as a default, you're like, you know.
Sure, there's the whole thing of like if Lara Croft was a male and you have like the guy wearing a tiny little
shorts.
Borat mankini thing, which is funny and true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's it's important to remember that there's different context for that. Sure. But yeah, I think it helps to be conscious that it's really easy to go, you know, oh, this is a cyberpunk setting, so everyone hates each other and they fuck each other and they shit and, you know, all the stuff.
Yeah.
They shit on each other's faces because it's a horrible dystopia. But remember which audience you're playing to.
Right. Yeah, you don't want to alienate your audience by...
Well, maybe you do.
Maybe you do.
But at least be mindful of the fact that showing these things is going to alienate. And then if people go, oh, man, that really turned me off, you can't go, but why? You know why.
Yeah, exactly.
You know the society they come from. Don't act shocked if this stuff, you know, gets to people because you know.
Yeah.
Nobody's that insensitive to culture that they don't.
Another thing to keep in mind is don't put this sort of thing in your game just for the sake, obviously, of putting it in your game. And, I mean, if you are going to put it in your... Well, here's the thing. And I'm going to bring up an example that Anatoly was just tweeting about last night that I have to tell him about next time I see him. I've told you about this movie. But, basically, if you're going to put stuff like this that is shocking, just make sure that you have a good story around it. And you're not just putting in these bits just for the sake of shock value or whatever with a crappy story. I watched this movie called Love, which is by this director Gaspar Noé, who basically it's essentially a 2-hour long porn movie about this guy. The story is that this guy is remembering this relationship that he had with this crazy woman I don't want to say crazy woman. She was a free spirit and wild child, I guess. That's how she's portrayed. And now he's in a very boring relationship with a girl that he got pregnant accidentally, but he stayed with her to raise the child, and he's not happy in his relationship, and he's remembering all the fun times he had with this other woman. And basically, as he remembers this, he, you know, we see scenes of him interacting with her, but then it always inevitably ends up with sex. And it's graphic, and it's unsimulated, and, you know, you see everything. And after a while, it just becomes like, oh, God, they're going to have sex again. Because there's no story linking it together, basically. It's very weak plot-wise, and it's super pretentious and stupid, and it just leaves you with a bad taste in your mouth because it's just awful. And the worst part is that I realized this after I watched it, is that it was in 3D. So there's a couple of scenes where there's actually one scene where the man just, like, fully ejaculates this insane amount into the camera, and if you're wearing 3D glasses, I assume that you're supposed to be getting it in your face or something, which is just ridiculous. And that just seems like they did it for the shock value, they did it because no one else has done it, and it doesn't add anything, and it comes off as stupid and comical more than anything else.
I also think, like, you know, I'm going to give the example of Blue is the Warmest Color, which is a film that I've seen,
right?
And that it comes again to, like we were talking about with Heavy Rain, the focus and the duration of.
Yeah.
You know, I get that the sex in Blue is the Warmest Color was an important part of the story. Mm-hmm. You know, it's characters learning about their sexuality and dealing with that,
mm-hmm.
and just relationship issues. But you don't have to show 15 minutes of, you know, of sex for me to get the idea that these people are having sex and liking it. You don't have to show that. You don't have to. If you want to show that, show it. I really believe that if you want to do something and you're the artist and you got to do it, you just got to do it, then do it. Whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, you're an artist, you might cop some flack for it, but you might cop some flack for anything you do in art.
Of course.
You don't come into art thinking that everyone's going to let you get away with anything. So if you want to do it, do it. But if you're trying to show a tender, loving relationship and the way you do it is by 30 minutes of just sex, that's not really conveying the full extent, and it's gratuitous is the word.
Yeah. It was the same with this movie.
Yeah.
I get that these people liked each other. I get that they had a very rocky, passionate relationship. I didn't need to see them having sex 17 times.
And even if you did, you know, you could show it in different forms than just 17 times of this is them having sex. You can show, you know, you can show it in ways that are more respectful to the viewer's time.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's such a deep issue because I'm that guy that called a game pissed because he felt like it.
Yeah.
You know, that's who I am. That's the context I come from. And, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, why did you call it that? Because I wanted to.
Yeah, sure.
And that's okay. You know, I come from being a fan of music, and in music, if you want to fucking do something, you do it. You know, that's been long established. You know, a lot of the barriers in music have been broken, and games haven't gotten to that level yet. But that's the kind of, you know, the high school punk rock. Oh, I want to call my band cunt, so I will. You know?
Yeah.
So it's sort of in doing that, I was kind of putting across this thing that I wanted to do. Like, I just want to do it because I want to do it. And people are like, but why did you do it? Because I had to. Because that's something I had to get out of me.
Mm-hmm.
I had this thing inside me that, you know, I wanted. And I had other reasons for calling it that. But mainly, I knew what I was doing. I'm not a moron. Mm-hmm. I knew that naming my game Piss would make people go, why the hell did you name his game Piss in all capital letters?
Mm-hmm.
Why the hell would you do that? I knew what I was doing. I'm not a moron. But not to that extent.
Yeah, I brought this up as an example before, but there was an AGS game, I forget what it was called, but there was a puzzle involving, you had to distract a guy, a janitor or something, and the way to distract him was by giving him a dirty magazine, and he gets the magazine and he's like, oh ho, and he goes off into a closet or something to look at it, and what?
I'm just imagining this as a real life scenario and like just finding some random security guy. I'm like, here's a porn mag.
Yeah. So
it's so bizarre.
Yeah. But this game got some flack for this because when he leaves and he goes into the closet and you go into the next room, there's a cutscene of him looking at the porn magazine with his pants down and he's, you know,
that's hilarious.
He's masturbating and you see him ejaculate and he falls over. See, you laugh at this, and I laugh at it too, because it's silly. But a lot of people were offended by this, and they were like, this is gratuitous, it doesn't add anything to the story, why did you put this in, blah, 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 blah. Same with the Reality on the Norm game about Guido and his giant, massive, floppy penis.
Yeah,
which I thought was funny, but it was also kind of weird because it was a character that I created. So, like, it's like
Here's the thing, man. If you do a guy walking around with a massive, comically floppy penis, you know what you're doing.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
You know, you're not that stupid. Come on, have some respect for our intelligence and for
your own. And it was a comedy game, so it was done for laughs. So it
that's right.
Like,
but I also think it is fitting to put in warnings.
Yeah. I guess.
You know, because you have to remember that people have children, people have, you know, if you come from certain religious or cultural contexts or backgrounds, mm-hmm. and you're playing a nice game with your family and that comes in.
Sure. Well, that's the
author hasn't warned you, then that is being a little insensitive.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you're going to go and put something so out of left field into a game that otherwise is portrayed as being something that's family friendly and whatever, then yeah, you obviously have to take that into consideration.
You know, if I'm at my grandma's house and I'm reading a magazine about video games and I turn to a page and there's something on there that might offend her, I'll be like, oh, I don't want to read this at her house.
Right.
If I'd known, I wouldn't have read it here because I don't want to, you know, it's you have to be a little bit sensitive.
Yeah.
And you do, and we know, we're not stupid. We know what offends people. We know what upsets people. And we know that certain things, there's a reason you give sort of notifications of this stuff.
Mm. Yeah.
It's not hard to do. You know,
So basically, I guess what we're trying to say is don't self-censor yourself. Put in what you feel needs to be put in a game, but also do take a little bit of time to consider what the ramifications of those things might be.
Yeah, have some sensitivity to your audience.
Yeah.
And the fact that, yeah, you're portraying this world that might be nothing at all like our own, and a culture that might be nothing at all like the ones that we come from, mm-hmm. but we are viewing it within our culture, and we are going to have an interaction. The audience is very much something that is a part of a game experience.
Mm-hmm.
One doesn't tell a story without the audience. So, yeah, it's a really big and complex topic, and it's hard to sort of... Yeah, some of it's hard to really explain. Like, you know, for me, the big one is why did I call my games silly titles? You know, all the different things that I called them. Why? Because that's who I am.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that it would annoy people. It annoys me.
Well, then.
I remember not being able to click on the title. I remember not being able to click on the new game thread of exclamation mark.
Oh,
I couldn't
right.
click on it because it's too small. And I was like, after being unable to click on it, being like, this is the stupidest idea. I can't even click the link. I was like, I should name a game, period, just so I can even click the link less.
Yeah.
You know, like, just to me, that stuff cracks me up. The fact that I can't even click the link of my own game is one of the funniest things that I can think of. You know, I make this game and I want to see what people are saying about it, but I can't even click the damn link because I'm such an idiot for calling my game this thing. But I knew I was being an idiot. I'm not going, oh, but, you know, sanctity of the artist or whatever it is. I just wanted to be an idiot. I love being an idiot. You know, that's who I am, you know.
That's fine.
And I was totally knowing, like, you don't call your game that, which is why I did it.
Mm-hmm. Good.
So, yeah.
Good. Well,
big
I think
topic.
we should wrap up.
We've run out of time, really.
Yeah, well, we haven't run out of time. We're not self-censoring ourselves. We can talk however long we want, but I'm hungry because it's 2 o'clock and I want lunch.
To our audience.
That's true too. Our audience doesn't want to sit
saying all episode.
Yes. We don't want to. Yeah. Anyway, yes, that's our topic. Thanks for listening. If you have any comments or anything, feel free to reach out to us. I know this is a topic that people will probably have thoughts on. Yeah. So.
We've had a few good discussions on the forums.
On the forums. So the forums is a good place to do it, but you can also do it on Twitter. You can follow each of us individually. I'm at Grunislav Games.
I am at Ben underscore 304,
and
together
we are
at BCT
underscore podcast. So, yeah.
You know what surprises me?
What's that?
Trolls hasn't sent us a voice message yet, despite the fact that I specifically told him not to do it so that he would do it.
Really? I always got the impression that Trolls... I always get the impression that Trolls, like, respects us more than he really should. And I think he's...
It's a mistake.
It really is. He's always very polite when dealing with me. He's always like, oh, sir, I don't want to bother you, you know.
I think he's just a polite guy.
He is a very polite guy, but...
Which is a weird thing to say about Trolls.
Well, I mean, he's, you know, he's a lot of things, but polite is one of his better qualities. I'm sorry, Trolls. I didn't mean that to sound as insulting. Well, he is a lot of things. He's Danish. He's tall. He's
Come on.
He's a fan of Space Quest.
I just wanted to bait him into making a voice message again, and you've taken it too far.
Yeah, I guess I always take it too far. Anyway, yeah. All right. Next week. You'll be here, so we probably won't do a pod. Yeah, hopefully we won't be a pod. We won't if you don't get turned away at the border for being too goddamn Australian.
I'm pretty goddamn Australian.
Yeah, so next week we'll probably take a little break because you're getting here on Saturday afternoon, and unless you want, I highly doubt you're.
I'm not a flaming wombat.
Yeah,
let's not be silly about this.
You're not gonna get off the plane and be like, "Hey, I've been traveling for 30 hours. Let's record a podcast." So,
I mean, I wouldn't be any less
incoherent
than the normal way of doing it.
Anyway, next podcast we record, you will most likely be we'll be in the same room. But we'll figure it out. Anyway, yeah, thanks for listening and take care of
Merry
yourselves.
Merry Christmas to you all.
Yeah, and I'd like to stroke it.